WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That is always in front of you right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. And that is what we all want. So we're still in our coronavirus separation mode. And during this time, a film was released just in the last few days, I think, by Michael Moore. It's about clean energy. And I just watched it yesterday. I'll start out by saying that I don't object to all parts of this film. Not a very resounding endorsement, huh? There are parts of the movie that are valuable, and any discussion of environmental issues, and especially the climate change crisis that we're facing, is a good thing. Well, almost any discussion is good. Unless, of course, it happens to be based on misinformation, dated information, cherry-picked information, and ends up painting an inaccurate picture of the topic at hand that's going to be misused by many people who would love for the world to be misled about this topic. And this is what I see Michael Moore's movie as having done. So since this movie was all about throwing doubt on the value of clean energy to address the climate crisis, I wanted to talk to one of Long Island's iconic figures in the world of clean energy, the head of Renewable Energy Long Island's longtime clean energy advocate, Gordian Rocky. We'll discuss some of the points from the movie, but we're really going to focus on what the movie did not portray. That is the promise of, the need for, and the successes of clean energy from winds to solar as integral parts of the solution to our climate crisis. Now, without getting into too much detail, as we'll devote a full show to discussing this film soon, I'll let you know that what these filmmakers did was find the very worst examples and characteristics of each form of clean energy and then focus solely on those negative points. While wind power is, according to our best experts, a massively important part of the solution to our climate crisis and to our pollution problem, the film highlighted one wind farm that resulted in the cutting down of a lot of trees. That was the main focus of their coverage of wind. And in their apparent effort to make solar power look as bad as possible, they highlighted a solar power array that was getting 8% efficiency. They stated that. The fact of the matter is that that might have been an accurate portrayal of solar power over a decade ago and then some. But now solar panels are getting around 20% efficiency, easily twice as much as what they said. And FYI, during today's interview with Gordian Rocky, you're going to learn why solar panel efficiency is not as meaningful as you think it is. And it's certainly not indicative of anything negative about the efficacy of solar panels. So stay tuned for that fun fact that you can then share. The film also quoted someone who said that solar panels last for only 10 years. Gee, that's weird, considering that everybody else knows that they last for more than twice that amount of time. And if you need proof of that, consider that many manufacturers give a 25-year warranty on their panels. I know that my panels will be operating and providing clean energy for 25 years and then some, since the end of the warranty does not mean the end of their service life. And those panels with 20% efficiency and 25-year warranties are the kind of panels that you and I can get for our homes today. Now, why would they use such inaccurate information about the efficiency and life of solar panels if their intent was to have an honest discussion? What they neglected to mention, which I think is essential when making the fair point about the carbon footprint of a clean energy technology, is that the carbon caused by creating solar panels is, by some accounts, about 10% of the carbon created by burning fossil fuels to create that same amount of energy that your solar panel would have created. That means that solar panels make up for the energy that it took to manufacture them in just 3 years of their 30-year life. The film also made it seem like they were uncovering a deep, dark secret that solar panels and electric cars actually use fossil fuels to make them, and wind turbines use concrete to create their towers. Can you imagine that? In a world where most of our power is being generated by burning of fossil fuels, these manufacturers of products that are providing the raw materials for us to break our dangerous fossil fuel addiction are actually using our electric grid for energy. Horrible. I'm being sarcastic here, if you didn't pick that up. And worse yet, did you know that electric cars get charged with electricity from plants that burn fossil fuels? Gotcha. Shame on those dirty vehicles. Shame on those deceptive manufacturers. I'm still being sarcastic here. The fact is that we absolutely need to electrify our vehicles, as well as our heating and cooling of our homes and buildings. Because as you will hear during this interview, we're on our way toward creating a clean energy grid. That means that the electricity that comes to your home will be in the future created by wind power on Long Island. So your car and your currently run by oil or natural gas home heating system can all in the future be run on electricity, and that can be powered by a clean grid. That's where we're going. My geothermal home heating and cooling system are a perfect example of taking a system off of fossil fuels and putting it onto electricity. And in my case, that electricity is being created by our solar panels. That's where we need to go. I'll also mention briefly that the film goes to great lengths to put down biomass. That's the burning of trees to create energy. Those watching this film might logically have assumed that burning biomass is what all environmentalists are pushing for. Let me set the record straight. In all the environmental meetings, discussions, interviews, and speakers we've hosted and watched over the course of 30 years, and there are a lot of them, not one of them has put forth biomass as a solution to the climate change crisis. Not one of them. So with that, I'm going to ignore that entire part of the film. And that was a substantial part of the film. Some people said it was about 45 minutes worth of the film. It's also worth noting that on the topic of biomass, they did a real job on Bill McKibben from 350.org. Now, I've had my issues with Bill McKibben's focus in that he was a laggard when it comes to telling people about the devastating central role of livestock production on climate change. Despite the fact that that sector is responsible for more climate change gases than all forms of transportation combined, when I asked him years ago, and again, I'm not holding him to account on this today, but when I asked him years ago about if he's educating on that issue, his response was something to the effect that people need to eat. Now, that's maybe an example of what Michael Moore was upset about. That is, pushing technological solutions to climate change while ignoring the fuel behind the problem, which is rampant overconsumption. Back to the point, the film showed Bill McKibben on a podium saying how superior burning wood was to burning coal. And so you would have taken from that scene that Bill McKibben was strongly standing behind burning wood instead of coal as a clean energy solution. What they didn't tell you in the film, however, is that since that clip of him was taken over a decade ago, Bill McKibben has done a 180 on his position on biomass. McKibben states that biomass used to look like a good idea as an alternative to coal. But when they, quote unquote, did the math, they realized it was not actually a solution, as it ended up putting more carbon into the atmosphere today when we need to cut back the most. In Bill McKibben's words, he says, "And as the science emerged, I changed my mind, becoming an outspoken opponent of biomass." He also says that something else happened too during that time. The efficiency of solar and wind power soared, meaning there was ever less need to burn anything. So why would these filmmakers use a dated clip of someone making a statement that does not accurately portray their current position on the issue? In my opinion, that's not being fully honest. And if they can be misleading in the ways that I've pointed out so far, they will be and were misleading on other points. How very disappointing. Really disappointing, coming from Michael Moore. And the problem is, while those of us in the environmental community will continue to talk about the inaccuracies and shortfalls of this movie, those in the media and politics who are climate change deniers are savoring and sharing every clean energy bashing line from this movie. This movie produced by liberals and self-professed lifelong environmentalists. Worse yet, this film was released during an election year, where the most important campaign issue is, in my opinion, climate change. Since the window is closing on our ability to act before it's way too late. And you'll hear more about that in a moment. And that brings us to our guest for today's show. I've been doing nonprofit health and environmental education since 1990. And from as far back as I can remember, there was a guy whose presence was synonymous with clean energy. He was viewed as a clean energy hero. Yes, someone has actually said that he is their hero. And he would give powerful talks way back then on wind and solar, and he would show the audience his electricity bill that was close to zero. Now, keep in mind, this was at a time when solar power was in its infancy. And not many people had it back then. Today, it's all over the place. Gordian Rocky did have it way back then. And he did have it because he clearly believes, and he believed, in the message that he has consistently been promoting since 1993. Since that time, Gordian has been a prominent voice in regional energy issues and is regarded as a clean energy expert, not just by me and my friends in the environmental community, but by the regional media, elected officials, and the public. I've worked with Gordian on a number of efforts, from the Long Island Climate Action Network to the Clean Energy Roundtable to WindsWorks for Long Island, and likely more that I'm not recalling. Gordian serves on a number of advisory committees and is a Climate Reality Leadership Corp mentor trained by Al Gore. Gordian holds a degree in civil engineering from Darmstadt University of Applied Sciences and lives in an energy-efficient and solar-powered home in East Hampton, New York. Welcome to The Healthy Planet, Gordian.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on your show again. It's been a while.
It has been. It's been many years. It could have even been close to a decade. Gordian, I want to start by giving you credit, which you deserve, for all the work and all the accomplishments that you've been behind for so many years. People as committed as you are, who put their whole life into these issues, are critical to the survival of our ecosystem. And you've been doing this decade after decade, which makes you really a very, very rare commodity. So thank you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the kind words.
The world right now is a different place than it was in 1993 when you got started in this. We're now living in a world where the proverbial clock is ticking. In fact, some say that it's too late to avoid the very worst impacts of climate change. As I briefly discussed in my intro, the new Michael Moore film on clean energy seems to have sought out the very worst characteristics of solar and wind that they could find. And one of the factors they discuss is the carbon footprint and the ecological footprint of these technologies. So Gordian, explain what's meant by carbon footprint of energy, and then talk about what we know about the carbon footprint of clean energy from wind to solar power as compared to, obviously, fossil fuels from natural gas to coal.
Yeah, well, let me just set the stage by mentioning the fact that we have a climate crisis, or some people call it a climate emergency, that we're facing. I and many others have pointed out for many, many years that climate change is probably the greatest challenge we as humanity have ever faced. And we need to heed the warnings we've been getting from climate scientists for decades, frankly. we've not heeded those warnings, and it is now getting very, very close. We may have a few years, maybe a decade left to, as they call it, bend the curve of carbon emissions down, which brings us to the crisis we are all facing right now, the COVID crisis. Scientists have warned us also for many years about the potential of catastrophic pandemics. And we know what happens when we ignore those warnings and sometimes alarm calls. With that being said, I'm happy to talk about any and all issues you can think of. The carbon footprint, when we talk about a carbon footprint, it's essentially the greenhouse gas emissions. We measure them in carbon dioxide equivalents or carbon. The greenhouse gas emissions that you or I or a company or a country causes by virtue of a number of things, but primarily it is typically the burning of fossil fuel. The burning of fossil fuel counts for about 72% or so of our overall carbon emissions from human activities. So burning fossil fuels means that we get energy out of it, which we need to run our economy, obviously, and our lives. But it also means that we are emitting huge amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And by changing the makeup of this relatively thin layer of our atmosphere, we are building up the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere. It's now over 400 parts per million, way out of the natural realm that it's been for millions of years. We're now overpowering nature's carbon cycles. And as a result, the globe is warming, the whole planet is warming. Some people have said we're cooking the planet. And that will lead and is already leading to significant and potentially disastrous effects. And life as we know it may not be possible anymore if we continue that. So the scientists tell us that we have to limit this warming effect to about 1.5 degrees Celsius. Definitely can't go over 2 degrees Celsius in order to avoid these catastrophic impacts. And we got to do so very quickly. We got to bring emissions down somewhere between 80 and 95% by mid-century, by 2050 or before. And that's a tall order, but that's what we got to do. I mean, we don't have the option to wait any longer. We don't need to wait any longer, because we have all the tools in our toolbox that we need to solve that particular crisis. And we got to do it starting today.
Indeed. And you mentioned all these factors that are involved in the carbon rising above levels that we've never seen before in millions of years. And it's amazing to me how frequently the stories are coming out that are mind-boggling stories. Just a few days ago, another story came out saying that there could be 3 billion refugees in the world by 2070, because the temperature where they live is too hot. Humans can't live where it's too hot to that degree. And so if you don't have air conditioning, you will die from the heat. And that's just astounding. And when you add that on top of the fact that we're talking about that there could be billions of refugees because there are melting glaciers that will no longer provide water to people who have forever relied upon them for their source of water, for their farming. And then you could have more billions of refugees that come from rising sea levels. Much of our population lives on the coastal areas. And so when you put this all together, we become a planet of refugees as the result of not treating nature the way it needs to be treated.
Yeah, absolutely right, Bob. And I remember a study that the Pentagon had commissioned some years ago, probably a decade ago now or so. And that study identified climate change as having the potential to present the greatest national security threat for the U.S., which is a pretty big deal.
It is
and that's exactly because of this potential migration of millions and millions of climate refugees. We've seen some of that already happening in the Middle East and Syria and other places. It's not the only reason for the conflicts there, but it is one contributing factor to the conflicts.
Sure. And some of the droughts in Central America were responsible for people coming over our border.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the response of our federal government was to cut off aid that would have helped them with their drought, which would, of course, create more refugees. Now, things are not being handled the way they need to be.
Yep. No, we got to act on this now because, you know, nature doesn't negotiate. When nature has a deadline, and we in fact now have a deadline, we can't say, give us another 10 years.
Yeah.
The ice just melts. The sea levels just rise. There's nothing in the world, whether we believe, quote unquote, in climate change or not, to change that deadline that nature has now set us.
Yeah. Let's get back to talking about solar panels. And by the way, I am mentioning this film, this Michael Moore film, a few times. On one hand, I hate to do so because I don't want to give it any more publicity or any more recognition than it deserves. And it doesn't deserve any. But the film did talk about the efficiency of solar panels. And they were talking about it in a way that made you say, oh, wow, this solar array that they were looking at only was getting an 8% efficiency. Right now, you'd have a hard time purchasing a solar panel that's 8% efficient. But put the efficiency of solar panels into some context so that when people hear that these solar panels were 8 or 22%, that they don't freak out from that. They understand what that actually means.
Yeah, solar panels have an efficiency, conversion efficiency of about 15 to 20% now. So, you know, you can get panels that may even be at 22%.
Yep.
But it's really not a very meaningful metric because when you get only 20% out of something that is a free resource, namely sunshine, and you're quote unquote wasting 80% of it, what's your loss? It's zero, right? So people who ask me about the efficiency of solar panel, I tell them that, but I also tell them maybe you should ask about the efficiency or lack thereof of your car, of your home, and a few other things. Because there, you are actually paying for every kilowatt hour, or every unit of energy that you're wasting. And that costs you a lot of money, and it causes a lot of problems in terms of air quality and climate change. So if you can, get solar panels, whether they're 18% efficient or 17 or 20, because you're going to be doing the right thing. You're going to save yourself a lot of money. And don't worry about the sunlight that's wasted. There'll be some more the next day.
That's a good point. And those efficiency numbers that they gave in the film were somewhere around 10, 12 years old. That would have been a normal efficiency back then, I understand. And so looking forward, is there any projection as to how quickly that number rises?
It's going up because they are improving the efficiency of the panels, yep. But the improvements are gradual and marginal. We're not going to get solar panels that will be 100% efficient, that's for sure. There's actually a physical limit to the efficiency in a conventional solar cell. Again, it's not really super important unless you run a space mission and want to fly to Mars where you have a limited amount of space on your spaceship. But we're talking about more terrestrial affairs here.
Yep. And just to give people a little understanding about the fact that you don't have to wait for more efficient solar panels. The best time to put solar panels on your house is today. And I put solar panels on our house about 5 years ago, and we just got another set. We went for exactly the same panels that were somewhere just under 20% efficient, just for the purpose of our last conversation. And we got the same ones. Not a whole lot has changed. And we did so because the price was better and we were able to get a great deal on it. So
that's right. Yeah. And you know, you're absolutely right. You know, you're not going to save more if you wait longer. You're going to lose money every month when you send a check or make
exactly.
that transfer to your utility company. So you're throwing money out the window. It's just like renting a home versus owning a home. When you own solar panels, you own a power plant. You are your own utility company. You own your power generating station on your roof, and you're paying into your own pocket. You know, you're making that initial investment, but that's equity that you're investing in, and it's your equity.
Yeah.
So don't wait.
Don't wait. No, it makes no sense. If you've got the sun, it's one of those no-brainers in life.
Absolutely.
So you've been in this field for decades, and you've witnessed and have actually influenced the implementation of solar installations on Long Island. Talk about some of the changes you've seen over these decades, because people looking at it now as if it's a snapshot just see, oh yeah, solar, it's just what is what it is. What was it like at the beginning when you started this, and how has that changed?
You know, I remember seeing my first solar installation in Riverhead. Somebody had an off-grid installation and gave me a tour of it. I was fascinated of that, but it was sort of homemade stuff, and it didn't take long. I think it was in 2000 or 2001 that we had advocated for LIPA offering a solar rebate program and starting a program. It was part of a national effort by the Department of Energy. It was called the Million Solar Roofs Program. We advocated for setting a goal of 10,000 solar roofs on Long Island, because that was sort of the population prorated share of our 1 million nationally.
I remember that.
And I remember the first year, I think it was in 2001, we had two solar electric systems grid connected on Long Island.
Wow.
And then every year, the numbers kept going up, and we ran these solar tours where basically people would go and see solar installations on Long Island. And that made a big difference, talking not to a salesperson or to an advocate like me, but to a homeowner that is showing you their electric bill and is saving money every month. That really worked well. And so now I just looked up the latest numbers. We've got over 50,000 solar arrays grid connected here on Long Island, for a total of 625 megawatts. That's more generating capacity than the last fossil fuel power plant that was built on Long Island in 2009, the Caithness Power Plant, which has 350 megawatt of capacity. So we've come a long way on rooftop solar and solar arrays on Long Island.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, my father had put a solar thermal system in, and that was in the late 1970s. And he had a geothermal system back then as well. So that was unusual.
Yeah. Well, solar thermal, solar hot water heating is still a great technology. We have a solar hot water array on the roof here. And of course, we also have solar electric. And when I had that installed, the first shower I took, I felt like an idiot. I said, why would I ever buy oil or gas or propane to heat my water? You know, if the sun can do it and do it for free. It's a great technology still.
Yeah. And for everybody out there, there are a couple of ways you can heat your water with solar. And one is that you have a solar panel that creates electricity that runs your hot water heater. Or you could have actually the solar thermal, which heats the water. And that's what you would shower with directly.
That's right. And if you want to run your hot water system with a solar array, there's a new technology now that's called heat pumps. So there are heat pump water heaters, just they're like they're heat pump air conditioners and space heaters. And so you can get much better efficiency when we're talking about efficiency, not from the solar panels, but from the water heater. So don't get a regular water heater. For that, get a heat pump water heater, and PSEG is right now providing $650 rebate on that heat pump water heater.
And I've got my check on the way, because 2 weeks ago, we put in a heat pump hot water heater.
Good for you.
Yep. Because if you're running your house from solar, you want to make sure that every bit of energy you're using is being used efficiently.
And exactly right.
You look at the whole equation, and as a society, we could be looking to do this. We created a society based upon waste, on excess. We had it. We have all this oil. We have all this gas. And so we could build buildings with no insulation and just, in effect, throw it away. But it's a new way of looking at things now.
Absolutely. And, it's funny because for hundreds, if not thousands of years, right, we have used only renewable energy to power our lives and our economies. And then suddenly, with the Industrial Revolution, we discovered, cheap oil and cheap coal and stuff like that. And we forgot all those skills of designing buildings properly so they take advantage of natural forces, the sun and the wind, et cetera, right? And the shade. We got to learn that again. And we are learning.
We are. And that makes you and I the conservatives.
That's right.
Because we're talking about being as conservative as the old days. We're going back to the old days. That's not right. This newfangled technology of coal and natural gas.
Yep.
So one of the common objections to clean energy is that they're not constant sources of power. It's not sunny every day. The wind isn't blowing every day. And the film that we're talking about stated that if you have a wind turbine farm and you have a power plant, that power plant has to be kept running the whole time. And it's very inefficient to turn it on and off. And therefore, it doesn't make any sense to put the wind in because you're still wasting all of that fossil fuel running the power plant. That has to be there for background. So explain intermittency, the challenge that this poses to areas that are moving toward having more solar, which is many at this point, and wind, as well as the solutions that exist.
Yeah, so utilities have always dealt very well with intermittency, and the intermittency I'm referring to here is on the, not on the supply side, but on the demand side. So our demand for electricity, for example, is intermittent, right? It goes up and down during the 24-hour period and during the year. So utilities have learned and learned very well to adjust to that continuously so that the grid can function as it should be. So when it comes to renewable energy, most, not all, but most renewable energy sources have some intermittency. Solar doesn't work at night, of course. The wind may be blowing at night, but there may be times when the wind doesn't blow, right? Hydropower is a little bit different because you essentially have built-in energy storage because you're damming water and you can release it when that power is needed. But the key to this is that you have a diversified portfolio of different renewable energy technologies and sources, that they are geographically dispersed and interconnected with a transmission grid, which can bring in energy from another part of the region where the wind may be blowing when it's not blowing over here. And you bring in additional energy storage, which we have in many forms, one of them being, as I already said, hydropower, but also electric battery storage or thermal storage. Your water heater stores hot water, that's thermal storage. The floor in my home stores solar energy that's coming in through the window, that's called thermal mass, etc. So again, these technologies, some of them are new. Some of them have been around for a while and are now getting more affordable. Some of them are hundreds, if not thousands of years old, like thermal storage. We've always done that in buildings. So we can manage that. Utilities have managed it successfully for more than 100 years. On the supply side, utilities have learned and are still learning to manage the intermittency of renewables.
Clean energy from solar to wind came out years ago as clean but expensive forms of energy, and they were alternatives to fossil fuels. We knew we needed them, but they were expensive. However, what we were perceiving as expensive wasn't taking into account the millions of people who die of the air pollution every year that comes from fossil fuel emissions, and of course, the cost to our ecosystem, our health, and our society going forward from climate change. So how do utilities now in 2020 look at the cost of wind and solar? How do they compare that to fossil fuels when they're making decisions?
So first of all, renewables have, as you said, several advantages. One of them already, as you mentioned, the advantage that they don't have externalities, external costs for which we pay at some later point, let's say through our taxes or through paying our doctor's bill when the kids have asthma or things like that. But renewables have a cost that does not include large-scale externalities, air pollution, climate change, etc. The other thing is that typically with renewable energy facilities, let's say a wind farm, the developer owns the wind farm and submits a proposal to the utility to sell that power at a fixed or agreed upon price for the term of their power purchase agreement, typically 20 years. So with renewables, the utility, and by extension, the ratepayers, the consumers, us, the consumers, know what we're going to pay for that. There are no fuel surcharges. There are no surprise bills we're going to get later on. because last time I checked, solar energy and wind energy was free, and there's no fuel cost adjustment necessary for that. And the third aspect of this is that renewable technology has improved tremendously, and renewable costs have come down, whether it's solar energy, wind energy, or many other renewable energy sources. Utilities making big investments in either purchasing or even developing their own renewable energy facilities, because it turns out in many places and in many cases that it's the least cost option. And that's not even accounting for those externalities. So, you know, in many places, wind turbines can generate electricity for less than coal power and less than natural gas-fired power plants. So to the utility, it becomes a no-brainer to invest in those kind of resources. It's good for us as utility customers in terms of our rates, and it's good for the planet in terms of our carbon footprint.
Yeah, things certainly have changed in the course of a couple of decades.
Yep.
And speaking of costs, talk about any of the studies that have been done on costs and the potential of ramping up to 100% clean energy in years to come.
Yeah, so you may remember this. I know you remember this. In 2012, we worked together with quite a few organizations here on Long Island to commissioned a study to essentially answer two questions. One was, would it be possible to generate 100% of our electricity on Long Island from renewable energy sources? And secondly, if the answer were yes on that, would it be cost effective? Could we afford it? Or would it be so expensive that it might be a nice idea, but we couldn't possibly pay for it? We had a very respected consulting firm that we hired for that, Synapse Energy Economics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They came back with those two answers. The first was, yes, this is absolutely doable. 100% renewable energy is 100% doable. And the second question as to the economic feasibility was that, yes, this will potentially cost a slight premium, but just a few dollars every month for the average ratepayer. So we said, great, then what are we going to do with this? I remember sitting around the office with a couple of staffers, and we said, so now we have a study. Studies typically sit on a shelf and collect dust. So we got to come up with next steps here. We said we need a pilot project. We need a community that's going to try this out and see if that's, you know, works in the real world. And the town of East Hampton in 2014 adopted a resolution unanimously, Republicans and Democrats on the town board, and set goals for the town of East Hampton to, on a community scale, community-wide, to meet 100% of electricity needs and later 100% of all energy consumption needs, transportation and heating and electricity included, from renewable energy sources. So I've been working very closely with the town of East Hampton on the road to meet these goals. The town of Southampton set a similar goal. There are now more than 150 communities in the U.S. that have set such goals. It caught on like wildfire. And I've been to Germany. I'm originally from Germany. I was over there a few times visiting communities. They have about 160 communities, a few years ago now, that have declared themselves 100% renewable energy communities. I've gotten tours of communities that have reached and in several cases actually exceeded their 100% renewable energy goals. Truly inspiring and amazing.
Absolutely. And that ties in with the New York State Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Talk about that and what that means for New Yorkers.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, I'm still pinching myself because when we issued that study, as you know, it was a wild idea. And I expected that a lot of people were going to say, "You guys are just nuts. This is just crazy. We're never gonna do that. It's ridiculous." Well, last year the state of New York adopted 100% renewable energy goals, essentially. So the state is now not just setting goals, but the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act is mandating at least an 85% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions below 1990 levels by mid-century, just as climate scientists have been telling us for many years. That's what we got to do. And a 40% reduction in emissions by 2030. We have their number of other mandates built in here. Talk about electricity. So by 2030, just 10 years away from now, 70% of our electricity must come from renewables statewide. And by 2040, 100% of our electricity has to be zero carbon electricity. And then the legislation actually has goals for particular renewable energy technology. So we have a mandate to have 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind by 2030 that would power about, or will power about, 6 million homes in New York State. We have a mandate for 6,000 megawatts of distributed solar. That's not even large solar farms. That's extra, but you know, distributed rooftop solar, etc. We have a mandate of 3,000 megawatts of energy storage that helps deal with this intermittency issue we had discussed earlier. We have energy efficiency goals and on and on and on. And also the Climate Act made some very important commitments to what we call climate justice and a just transition. In other words, transitioning the workforce that's now still employed in the fossil fuel sector, transitioning people to the clean energy economy. So that is a, I think, not only nationally, but worldwide legislation that is at the very forefront of solving the climate crisis. And I'm proud to be a New Yorker. And I have to give the legislature and Governor Cuomo a lot of credit for passing this act. It's really pretty amazing.
It really is. When you think of how far we've come, I know the first wind farm that was being considered on Long Island in the mid to late 2000s was 40 megawatts, right? That first one?
I think so. I think you're right.
Yeah. And now you were talking about 9,000 is what's being committed to.
Yeah, and they've gotten a lot bigger, those turbines, and they've gotten a lot better, and they've gotten a lot cheaper.
Yeah, that's amazing in such a short period of time.
And in Europe, I mean, again, you know, I've been over there. I saw my first offshore wind farm in Copenhagen in Denmark. You know, they've got thousands of offshore wind turbines generating clean electricity there. Yeah. And when I came back from there some years ago, I think it was in 2003. I've got the videotape still sitting here on my shelf.
I've seen your videos and your pictures.
Yeah. And yeah. I said, you know, if they can do it, we can do this. And here we are.
Yep. And that's all it takes. It takes a vision. And you see it demonstrated somewhere. Then you have to be a visionary yourself and bring that and say, we can do that too. Again, more credit to you for bringing that to Long Island.
Well, there are lots of people working on that, and I'm just doing a very, very small part. You're doing a part, and all of us are.
Well, we're all doing a small part, and all of us doing our small parts turns into something rather powerful. You've also been working on something called community choice aggregation that allows local governments to decide where we want to purchase our power from. And that's opening up the possibility for communities to choose more clean energy instead of just having to deal with the fossil fuel energy that's coming out of your power plant. Talk about how this works and all about the Suffolk County Task Force that you're working on with us.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, for the last 100 or so years, the decisions as to where our electricity comes from have been made in the utility boardrooms by utilities executives on behalf of us, really. We're the customers, but the decisions were made far away from where we live and by people far removed from everyday life in our communities. Community choice aggregation is a new, in New York State, a relatively new concept which allows towns and villages to actually decide where their power comes from. So under a CCA, a community choice aggregation program, a town would take over the power purchase function from the utility. The incumbent utility, in our case, LIPA and PSEG, are still responsible for delivering the power to us through the transmission and distribution system, are still responsible for maintaining that system, are responsible for billing and collections, etc. But deciding where we buy our power will be done by the town. So the town forms that community choice aggregation, enrolls all customers, pretty much all customers, into this program. Customers who don't want to be part of that and want to stay with the existing utility can opt out of the program. They're not forced to be in it. They can opt out. And as far as the typical customer is concerned, you wouldn't really know much of a difference until you look at your electric bill, where you may see some savings, or you look at where your power is coming from and you find out it's coming from a local solar farm or maybe from a wind farm that may be further away, but it's green power and it doesn't pollute the air and it doesn't contribute to climate change. The beauty of that system is that local people get to decide their energy future. And so this is a relatively new concept. It's been very successful in Westchester County. And now there are more than 60 communities in New York State that have adopted CCA programs. Just starting up here on Long Island, the town of Southampton have passed the enabling legislation, and a couple of other towns, Brookhaven and Huntington as well. LIPA is in the process of making changes to their electric tariff to allow CCA. We should very soon know whether the LIPA board approves that. We're hoping for June 1st. And once that's done, municipalities like Southampton and others can go out and through an administrator, get proposals from energy service company to offer power that they can purchase on behalf of their residents and businesses.
That's a good change. The main theme of the famous Michael Moore film is that clean energy has not worked over the past 30 years. Witness the fact that we're not dealing with the climate emergency the way we should. And as it's at its base, I see that argument as absurd, because it's not the failure of clean energy to create action on climate change, it's the failure of leadership. And when I see what's happened with the coronavirus, and I see that the governments put together a task force. They held press conferences every single day where people were tuned in for hours, getting all the details, seeing the progress, hearing all the information, getting informed. It's that kind of leadership that could actually create rather fast action on climate change. And he also says that, look, our air is cleaned up in a month when the environmental community couldn't do it for 30 years. Well, there it is, because we have the ability to do it because people think they're going to die if they don't. The fact is that climate change is posing as serious a threat to us. In fact, the seriousness of climate change is well beyond the coronavirus in terms of historical events. But here we are not addressing it as if it's an emergency. So what's your take on why we haven't collectively come to terms with what's becoming more and more urgent and more challenging every day?
Well, it's pretty simple. We have all the tools we need. We have all the technologies we need. You know, I'm an engineer, right? So I can't always say that for every problem we have technologies to solve that problem. But in the case of climate change, we have, for most cases, there are few exceptions to that. But in the electricity sector, we know we have all the technologies to generate 100% of our electricity from renewable sources, and in many other sectors as well. What we need and what's lacking is the political will, right? And then there is, of course, the issue that fossil fuels are heavily subsidized. Much they get much greater subsidies and have been getting that for decades than any renewable form of energy. And the fossil fuel lobby is still extremely powerful and well-funded and seems to influence elected officials to a great extent. So in New York State, we are lucky to have elected officials who have fully grasped the urgency of climate solutions and, as we just discussed earlier, have adopted a nation-leading, if not globally leading, climate legislation. And that's the case in a few other states, but not everywhere, and not everywhere in the world. We've made big progress on renewable energy, whether it's here or in China or in Europe. But this is a major transformation of a system that we've had in place for more than 100 years. It's not to be expected that we can change that system within a few years. This will take several decades. Yeah. It's a huge undertaking. We're essentially tasked with rebuilding the entire energy infrastructure and economic backbone, and that takes time.
It's a big ship to turn.
So we got to be cognizant of the scale of the required solutions and the obstacles we're facing. But we are now seeing the political will very forcefully here in the state of New York, in several other states and other parts of the world. I tell you, 27 years ago when I started,
yeah,
I didn't think I would live to see this. Yeah. And I'm getting up every morning and I got to pinch myself that these things are now actually happening. And yeah, it's great news.
Yep, it is great. Unfortunately, it's happening because the situation is so urgent and dire because it has to happen. Whereas 30 years ago, it was kind of like, we'll do that tomorrow. Yeah. So here we are.
I hope that we're learning something from the current crisis, you know, from the corona crisis, because sometimes it takes a crisis or maybe two or three to wake us up.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, but I hope that we will remember the lessons we're learning dealing with this right now and apply it to the next big crisis, which, as we know, is the climate crisis.
Yeah. And in terms of it not working, talk just a moment, because we only have 5 minutes left. A moment about what Tom Falcone, the CEO of LIPA, said on this show. And he was talking about what they were looking at in terms of demands for electricity going forward and how that demands curve had flattened.
That's exactly right. So as a result of energy efficiency improvements in homes and appliances and a lot of things, and more solar rooftops and larger scale renewable energy installations, LIPA's demand forecast had to be revised several times, actually. It was projected to continue to grow. It had to be revised, and it's essentially flat now and projected to be flat for quite some time. That's really good news, number one. The other good news is that LIPA, in its integrated resource plan that they put out a little while ago, essentially said, we will not be building any more of these big, bad baseload plants, as we call them, the big, large power plants, because that's not the way of the future and it doesn't fit our system needs anymore. We will instead invest in energy efficiency, in renewables, in battery storage, and maybe we're needed in a few small, rapid ramp-up peaker plants, if we need those. If we can do it with other technologies, renewables and battery storage, et cetera, we'll do that. So that's a major shift, a major game changer in how our public power entity, LIPA is public power entity, is now looking at the paradigm of providing energy to Long Island. So I have to give them credit as well, and Tom Falcone in particular, for that shift in thinking.
Absolutely.
So this stuff is working. Look, it's working on your roof, on my and my roof, as we speak. It's working large scale, and the utility companies, whether private or public, are catching on to it.
Yeah. Yep. I love my clean energy bill, which is zero for the energy I'm actually using, which is, it's amazing. So it's money saving, it's world saving, it's got everything going for it.
And it creates great job and economic opportunities, you know, and especially post-COVID in our recovery now, we need new infrastructure. We need to build the clean energy infrastructure to create new jobs and jumpstart our economy. So that's a great opportunity. And I hope when we come out of this, we'll hit the ground running with that.
Yeah. Long Island, we don't produce fossil fuels, natural gas to run the power plants. We're sending all that money, billions and billions of dollars off Long Island every single year.
That's right.
When I put solar panels on my roof, it's local people working. Local local companies.
Yeah, we got a great solar resource on Long Island. We got an amazing offshore wind resource here on Long Island. And rebuilding this infrastructure will create really well-paying and thousands of jobs, which is what we need, and create a lot of secondary and additional economic activity around that.
Let's finish up now, and I'll go back to the beginning. In order for someone like you to put themselves into this kind of work for so long, you have to have had a really strong motivation. What was your original motivation?
You know, when I see a problem, I think of a solution. And I see it as a challenge. I've always thought of myself as a problem solver. I guess that's why I became an engineer. I love solving problems. And if it's something of that scale where you know, we know this, the fate of humanity depends on it, how can I not do my part to help solve it? We can all help solve it. And if we do, we're going to make it.
That's great. And Gordian, you're the second engineer I've had on in the last few months. And both of you talked about seeing a problem and being naturally drawn to come up with a solution.
So that's our job.
That's your job. All right, Gordian Rocky, Renewable Energy Long Island, longtime clean energy advocate and someone we're all indebted to for all the years of service in promoting clean energy on Long Island. And of course, that has an impact on our world. So thanks for being with us, Gordian.
Thanks for having me on your show, Bob.
Such a pleasure. And on that note, my name is Bob DiBenedetto, and I want to thank you for listening to The Healthy Planet. I'll be with you again on Friday, June 5th at this same time. That's right, 6 p.m. on Fridays. For more info on any Healthy Planet events and radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And be sure to like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. When I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and The Healthy Planet shows every week at this time with great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. Until next time, stay strong. Keep moving, even at home. Relax. Make your voice heard in this world by speaking up for what's right, even if the political climate is challenging. Consider making your life more energy efficient in all ways. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world and temporarily clean air that we all share. Good night.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.